The Anchorage International Film Festival is already underway. Two of the films being featured this year focus on topics relevant to the entire state, civil rights and gender identity. I'm Ann Hillman. During today's Talk of Alaska, we're trying something new. During the first half of the program, we'll discuss the film Real Boy about Bennett Wallace and his family. Then we'll switch gears at the midway point and talk about Walk With Me, the trials of Damon J. Keith. Stay with us.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. If you have an opinionated teenager in your home who thrives on proving a point, check out the Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future Scholarship Competition organized by UAA's Seawolf Debate Program. More than $10,000 in prizes will be awarded. Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future gives the next generation of Alaskans a voice in the direction of our state. Contest details available at debatingakfuture.com. This message sponsored by Seawolf Debate. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Welcome to Talk of Alaska. For the first half of today's program, we'll be talking about the film Real Boy. It's a story about Bennett Wallace, his family and friends, and how their relationships evolved during Bennett's gender transition. Bennett is in the studio with me today. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you so much.
And the film's director, Shalice Haas, is joining us over the phone from Oakland, California. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure.
For all of you out there listening, I know callers like to wait until the second half to pipe up, but we're just sticking to this conversation for the first half, so please do join us early on by calling 550-8422 or 1-800-478-TALK. You can also email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. So, Bennett, tell me a little bit about the film.
Wow. So the film is called Real Boy, and it follows my journey through transition over 4 years. And really, it's not just about me. It's about my family, coming to terms with my experience, and it's about the chosen family that I created along the way to help support me on my journey when my family wasn't necessarily on board yet.
What made you decide to participate in a documentary that's really very personal?
It felt like my responsibility to my community. The queer community lifted me up in my darkest moments, and so I felt like maybe this could be my way of giving back to the people that have taken such good care of me.
And Shalice, what jumped out at you is this being an important story to tell?
Really, I was moved initially by Bennett, who's incredibly charismatic and talented, and I had met him at a live concert where he was with Joe Stevens, who was his mentor, and had just become friends. And I was struck by their friendship, by their relationship, not only their shared experience as trans men, but also their shared experience it with addiction, with music, and a way of developing chosen family that to me really resonated. And as a queer woman, I'm really interested in chosen family because I think it's something that in our communities we have cultivated for a very long time in really special ways.
So Bennett, how did you choose that relationship with Joe?
I didn't.
what happened?
It was just one of those beautiful serendipitous moments. Early on in my transition, I did a lot of Googling to see what my future might look like as a trans musician. And I was actually just really concerned about my voice and how is transitioning going to impact my ability to sing and share music. And so Joe Stevens was the first person that came up on my Google search, and I kind of kept that in my back pocket and in my memory. And I was at a sober youth conference speaking on a panel in Los Angeles about being young and trans and sober, and he was in the audience. And so as soon as I got up there and I said, "Hi, my name is Ben, I'm sober and I'm also trans," he basically gave me a standing ovation. And I knew at that moment that I was looking at another trans person, and it wasn't until afterwards that he came up to me And I was like, you look so familiar. I swear I've seen your face before. And he's like, well, you might know my band Coyote Grace. And I was like, oh, I was totally starstruck. and from then we just became fast friends, and he invited me to open for him in some of his shows, and
cool.
Invited me to live with him in Sacramento and record an album, and the rest is history.
You were the only trans kid on that panel.
What? Yeah, they had a really hard time finding a young trans sober person. Apparently we're like unicorns or something.
Why is that so hard?
Well, I mean, I think first of all, like, you know, you're looking at the intersectionality of quite a few communities. You're looking at a sober community and then young people's in this sober community. And then you're trying to find a trans person within Los Angeles that's part of these communities. And that was like five years ago. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot has probably changed in the meantime as far as, you know, there's probably a lot more people to choose from now. But at the time, I really was the only person that a lot of people knew going through this.
Because you were willing to be out about being sober, willing to be out about being trans?
Both, yeah, both.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And for me, I mean, they were so connected. I mean, my journey with addiction was directly related to my depression, related to my journey with gender.
Talk about that a little bit more. You mean you were using substances or to
yeah,
help?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was self-medicating because it was too hard to move throughout the world and be present with myself. So I really used drugs and alcohol as a way to check out from my feelings.
What made you finally decide to check back in?
Well, I was 17 and my parents gave me an ultimatum because I had stolen a lot of stuff from them and pawned it all off for drugs. And they told me that this is the last time that we're going to send you to treatment. And they sent me one more time and I went to sober living. And so it wasn't really a choice that I had made for myself, but rather one that my parents had made for me.
But it stuck, because oftentimes I've heard so many stories of addiction where until you decide on your own that that's the change you're going to make, it's not going to happen.
Totally. I think for me, the first thing that happened was that I fell into this awesome young sober community. And a lot of them happened to be a part of the LGBT community because this was in Los Angeles. So, I just fell into this loving group of people who hung out with each other and did things and helped keep each other sober. And that was the first time I really actually started to explore and allow other people to, you know, be a part of my questioning gender identity.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and you know, it's funny, like, I had a friend who was going to school and studying gender identity, and she was telling me all about this stuff. And this was like a year before I even came out, but she was telling me about all this stuff. And I was like, you know, when I hear about trans people, I think that that's me. And she was like, really? That's really interesting. And then I didn't talk about it again for a whole year. So,
wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting, like, the way that, you know, you don't know until you really know. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I had this, like, kind of a really interesting experience with myself looking in the mirror. And I had this crazy daydream where I was, you know, I was at the gas station down the street and I was getting gas and I said 20 on 4. And the guy behind the counter, and this is totally all in my head happening in a daydream. And he was like, yes, sir, ma'am, sir, I don't know. And I said out loud to myself in the mirror without really being conscientious of this daydream happening, it's sir. And I was looking at myself in the eyes and I just got full body chills. And that was the moment where I was like, whoa. okay. All right. I see it now, you know.
Mm-hmm. So we've talked a little bit about your chosen relationships with Joe and actually your chosen relationship with Shalice. I want to talk about your relationship with your mom, because in watching the film, I was like, oh, Bennett's supposed to be the protagonist, but whatever. You, from the beginning of the film, you knew who you were. You know who you are. But your mom. Mm. I mean, so there's a short clip of a conversation that you had with your mom when you were in your house and you were talking about transitioning, and I'd like to play that clip now.
This is how I'm going to explain it. I am literally a boy with the wrong body parts.
No, I just think, you know, that there is the argument of you're not.
I just don't get
it. I think it goes back to what defines what is a boy. Is it your brain or is it your body? In our hearts, you're Rachel. That's what we've known you as, and that's a hard habit to break. What's so wrong with the opinion of you are who you are and you get what you get? And
Is that why you got plastic surgery?
And then you go on and you're talking about, well, what about other modifications to your body? I'm going to jump to Shalice. Shalice, what was it like to be there for this conversation?
It was really intense, actually, to be, certainly in the early days of filming. We filmed for almost 4 years. And by the end, actually, you know, by a year in, we were all very close. And I felt a little bit like I got to be part of this family in a unique way. But on the first couple of shoots, we were all still getting to know each other, especially Susie and I. And so, you know, on the one hand, I felt like it was really important to show all the ways that relationships are messy, right? They're messy the way my family relationships are messy and pretty much everybody I know. But on the other hand, it was really emotionally exhausting. I would go home from a shoot and feel emotionally drained as if I had been arguing with my mom. but it was also really powerful, right? They were moments that were very real, and I felt so grateful to Bennett and Susie at different times in our filming with Joe and Dylan, everybody else in the film, for their willingness to allow me to be there at times that were really vulnerable.
Bennett, what was it like for you to have someone with a camera there while you're having such an intimate moment with your mom? It's your mom.
I mean, it was hard in the sense that I've always been really protective over my mother, and so I was scared for both of us and that we would say something later that we would regret, and that would be what was shared with our audiences. But at the same time, like I said before, this always just felt like something that was really important for me to do. And so when my mom became willing, it just really wasn't even a question. You know, it was like, absolutely, we need to share as many perspectives on my journey as possible.
Tell me a little bit more about your relationship with your mom. Like, has it always been smooth? Has it not?
I wouldn't say it's always been smooth, but my mom has always been my biggest support, especially through the years. I mean, I struggle with addiction and depression starting at like age 12. So it was a long time coming. By the time I started transitioning, I was 18. That's like a long time to watch your child really, really suffer. And in a lot of ways. So, I mean, my mom has always been in my corner and always trying to lift me up and support me in a positive way. And I think her understanding of what support is has evolved over time. And I'm super grateful to her for growing with me.
Shalice, what do you think your role was in helping Susie transition in her own way?
Well, a lot of this is in hindsight, because when I was making the film, I spent a lot of time really thinking deeply about my role as a filmmaker. I also felt like I was balancing my hats as filmmaker and friend,
and
really
therapist.
Trying to hold with as much, you know, respect and love my relationships with everyone in the film. And it wasn't until afterwards that Susie was able to say, you know, I think it's hard to know, but I think that there were ways in which for her being forced to talk about these things, because I would kept coming back with my camera and saying, tell me how you feel, because there was someone there asking her how she felt asking her to reflect, asking her to think about it, asking her to talk about it, that there was a way in which that helped her move forward in her journey of acceptance, possibly faster than if she had been able to do what she prefers to do often, which is kind of avoid a little bit. And that's something she's shared with audiences and with me. So I feel really grateful about that. You know, my philosophy about documentary film is a little different from some others. You know, I think there are a lot of people who feel like you should be a completely objective observer and a fly on the wall, and that's the most, you know, the highest form of documentary filmmaking. And I think for me, I believe that you're always present mm-hmm. in a film as a director, whether someone sees you or hears you or not, that the relationships that I had with everyone in the film are part of what you feel when you watch the film. And so so to me, I feel like my perspective, the lens through which I see the world, as, you know, just as an individual, as a queer woman in community, as someone of a particular age, or all of the ways in which I show up, those things are present in the film, and the relationships are present in the film. So I feel really grateful that was actually supportive for Susie in her process. And I don't, you know, I don't feel like I meddled in the story in the sense that it was changing the outcome or asking people to at any point do or say anything they wouldn't otherwise. But I do believe that the relationship of having me there, just by its very nature, had an influence.
I think that's true in not just documentaries, but also lots of forms of journalism. Just the fact that you're there and the way you tell a story shapes the story. And yeah, for all the listeners, how did your relationships change when you went through adolescence? How did your relationships change with your parents? How did you figure out who you really are? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-478-TALK or 550-842. You can also email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. I want to talk about your relationship with Joe Bennett. Mm-hmm. But before we do, there's just one more clip about your mom, because it kind of shows the evolution that she went through. And it's actually, she decided to end up joining you in Florida when you had your top surgery. And then while you were in the operating room, she took a walk with your best friend's mom, who was also having surgery at the time. So this is the clip with her speaking with your friend's mom, and it starts with her, the mom.
But, you know, we're all at different places. That's the whole thing. We don't have to necessarily understand it completely and fully. We just have to support them and love them.
True.
Love them through it. That's all you can do. Be there and love them and support them.
Nailed it on the head. It's like, don't really understand it, but
there's so many other people in this world that would love to bring them down. We just have to make sure we're not any of those people.
What did it feel like when you first saw this footage?
Oh my God, it was such an incredible insight into the journey that my mom was on, you know, because I wasn't there for that conversation, and had it not been for this film, I really wouldn't have ever seen it. So for me, I mean, first things first, I had so much love for my friend Dylan's mom holding space for my mom, because I think Dylan, my best friend's mom, was a little bit farther along in her acceptance of her son's journey. So I think to have her there consoling my mom in a really major, major way was really special to be able to witness.
Mm-hmm. Is Dylan still in your life?
Oh, absolutely. He's like my brother, yeah.
Tell me about him.
He's awesome. He actually just became an EMT.
Cool.
So yeah, he got into a terrible car accident actually a few years ago. He got hit by a semi truck driving a 70s VW bus, going 60 miles an hour on the highway.
Wow.
And I think in some ways that really changed the trajectory of his life, and inspired him to get involved in being a part of other people's healing and recovery.
So how did you meet him? In the movie, he plays this sort of kind of goofy fun role.
That's the role he plays in my life in general. Yeah. We had mutual friends who realized that they both had a young trans friend who was at the beginning of their journey, and they were like, we have to introduce these guys. And it was like, you know, a week after that I started showing up to Dylan's house before he was even out of bed having breakfast with his family. So it was, it was a fast friendship.
And then you went through the stages of transition together, lived together through college.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We did everything together.
Shalise, why was that relationship so important to you to include into this film?
Oh, for so many reasons. I mean, I think one of the themes that goes throughout the film is this idea of mentorship and peer support. And watching Bennett and Joe's relationship, which was really one of a mentorship, in a lot of ways, you know, it seemed that Bennett would look at Joe as a role model in certain ways. Joe would often look at Bennett as, you know, a version of his younger self. But with Dylan and Bennett, they were best friends, they were peers. There was a really unique process of simultaneous discovery, not only around issues of gender, but also just growing up, going from adolescence to young adulthood. And it was a really sweet friendship. And they made me laugh all of the time, on camera and off. And so it also, I think, was wonderful for the film in the sense that audiences laugh a lot. You know, there's a lot in this film that is hard. There's a fair amount of crying, but there's also a lot of laughter and delight. And so I think Bennett and Dylan, you know, independently are very funny people, but together are a pretty special pair. And I said to them both over time that they should consider getting their own web series or podcast or something, because it's a real pleasure to be around them.
Something you're considering in your spare time, Ben?
Oh, yeah. I have a plan to just, you know, I think because of the way that our audiences have received this film and the way that it's resonated with so many people across the world. I mean, I just got back from Ireland and Joe's in Scotland. They've been in Italy. It's been everywhere. And so for me, it's really important to maintain that connection with the audiences and keep them updated, because this film, as you know, it was shot over 4 years, but it still does feel like it's in my past. And so I would like to bring people into my present.
So how old were you when the film was shot, and how old are you now?
It started filming when I was 18, and I am about to turn 24 in just a few days now.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is quite a change. So where are you in your life right now?
Oh, man, I am all over the place.
Okay, other than scattered.
I've been doing a lot of touring with this film since our premiere in April, and that's pretty much been, the focus of my time and energy. But I am a musician, and I love to sing, and so I'm actually kind of in the pre-production stage for my next album. So that's where I am. I've got a girlfriend and two dogs that we love, and an RV that we just traveled the United States in, going to a bunch of national parks, and made it back in time to catch all these film festivals and screenings.
Sweet.
Yeah. No, and I'm stoked to be in Alaska. I never thought that I was going to come in December for my first trip, but I'm really happy to be here because Alaska's been on my bucket list for a long time.
Nice. As you were traveling around in your RV, I had no idea you did this. How much do you feel your role is to educate people about what it means to be trans versus just living your life?
It's a very interesting balance, and I think that's a really great question, because I think there is this, you want to maintain your personal safety at all times. That's my biggest, my biggest concern. And at the same time, you want to challenge people, and you want to challenge their worldviews and the way that they, assume things about other people. And so I try and take every opportunity that I can to challenge people when it's there, and I think because of figures like Caitlyn Jenner and other things happening in the media, it surprised me at first, But I hear conversations about trans people happening all the time. And so I do feel like it's my responsibility to step in. And it's not always, I don't always say, hey, I'm a trans person and what you're saying offends me. But sometimes it's just challenging people and saying, excuse me, like you're using the wrong pronoun for Caitlyn Jenner. She's a woman, you know, and I don't care what you think about her or her politics or anything else, but she's a woman, you know. And if they don't choose to, you know, respect that, or take that and change their worldview, that's, you know, that's not my problem. But at least I've, you know, planted that seed. And maybe the next time somebody challenges them, they'll say, okay, this isn't the first time I've heard that. Maybe I should look a little bit deeper into, you know, the way that I think.
Mm-hmm. Shalice, in making this film, did you want it to be educational or did you want it to be something else?
You know, I didn't set out to make a film that was educational first and foremost, right? This wasn't the genesis of this film was not about, showing people what it's like to be trans. I couldn't do that even if I had tried, right?
Yeah.
It's not my own lived experience. It's only one story. It's certainly not representative of the broader trans community or communities, which are really diverse.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe very strongly that intimate personal stories have a phenomenal power to, you know, to touch people. And when you touch hearts and when you invite people to feel deeply and get to know people in a film deeply, that has the capacity to change minds. And, you know, at the very least to sort of open a window to additional inquiry or thinking. We've developed a discussion guide that goes with the film that really takes the educational piece to the next level. But the film itself is, you know, is meant to be an experience. And I think one of, you know, a really lovely piece of feedback we've received often from audiences is, wow, this, you know, this felt like a fiction film in ways. And, you know, I think some of the best documentaries, they're not meant to, you know, they shouldn't feel like eating your peas, you know. but this film, I think, especially is absent of any kind of experts telling you what to think or anything else. It's really just contained in the world of Bennett and Joe and Susie and Dylan and Dylan's parents and Joe's parents and the evolution of their relationships over 4 years. And so I think a lot of people feel not that they're learning something about someone else who may be different from them, but rather that there's a story that they can identify with, that they feel a resonance of their own lives, whether they are trans or not.
Because everybody has relationships with parents. Well, most people have relationships with parents. Most people have relationships in a mentor sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Shalice, do you have any mentors who really stand out to you? Things... people who have changed your life?
Was that question for me?
Yeah, that was for you.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think I feel incredibly grateful also to be surrounded by a tremendous community. I have my own chosen family. And so in many ways, the people that I choose to spend my time with, the people who will... you know, where those relationships go beyond sort of a just friendship, where they really are the people that I can call in the most dire of emergencies or non-emergencies, but that know me most deeply, are also people that I look up to, even if in other ways we're peers. You know, I'm so impressed by the creativity and the wisdom of the people in my life. So I would say, yes, I have mentors, but they are also the... You know, I feel like I'm inspired by the people in my life, and for that I'm hugely grateful.
Well, I'd like to thank you both very much for joining us on the show today. That was Bennett Wallace, star of the film Real Boy, and director Shalice Haas. The movie airs tonight at 8 p.m. at the Beartooth as part of the Anchorage International Film Festival. You can see the whole schedule online at anchoragefilmfestival.org. But if you miss Real Boy tonight, Alaska Public Media will be screening the movie again this spring as part of the Independent Lens series. So stay tuned to Alaska Public Media and find out more about that. When we come back, we'll be talking about the documentary Walk With Me, The Trials of Damien J. Keith.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. For this portion of the show, we're going to focus on the film Walk With Me, The Trials of Damien J. Keith. It's a story of one judge and four trials that changed civil rights laws across the nation. In the studio with me is the film's director, Jesse Nesser. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
What did you learn about civil rights growing up? Do you have stories about experiencing discrimination? What did you do about it? Share your stories with us by calling 1-800-478-TALK or 550-8422. You can also email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. So, Jesse, how did you find Judge Damien Jake? How did you find the judge's story?
Well, his story kind of found me. He had a biography that was coming out, came out about 4 years ago about his life, and I was brought on at the last minute to do a 2-minute promotional piece where he sits down and tells one of his stories. Only had to be 2 minutes. We were going to throw it up on the website and see what happened. I'd never heard of him before. It was a very last minute ask. I walk in and turn the camera on, and Judge Keith starts telling one of his many, many stories. And he's the quintessential grandfather telling a story. And like I said, it had to be 2 minutes. An hour later, the camera clicks off because I'd run out of tape. That was the only reason why I turned the camera off. So the first time I met him was actually filming him. And so it was a pretty instantaneous connection.
And when you went in, what story did you think you were going to tell? And actually, what did you focus on in 2 minutes?
Well, Judge Keith is one of these guys where you could ask him any question, he'll just take it back to the beginning, no matter what question you ask him. You know, it's one of these where, well, it really starts back in 1922 when, but I had asked him about his time in World War II. He's a World War II veteran of a segregated army who then was a janitor, and he became a federal judge. So from janitor to judge. And so I made the mistake of asking a very open question to him and sort of asked him about, you know, how do you go from janitor to judge? And he said, well, it all starts back in 1922. And he was born on July 4th in 1922, and that's where our story kind of starts.
All right. So just to give people a sense of what this movie is about, I want to play a short clip from it. The movie's a lot of different things, but there's four key cases he was involved with.
That's right.
And this particular clip deals with his case against the city of Hamtramck. And it starts with the lawyer and then one of the former residents of the city of Hamtramck in Michigan. And they're suing the city over housing discrimination.
The sewer system didn't work. The roads were not repaired. We had some houses that were abandoned where full-size trees had grown up inside those houses. And people are supposed to live around this. So, you can make it where you don't want to be there.
They treated me like I was less than a human. I didn't have no rights. One of the issues was the siting and location of I-75 freeway. And what the city planners did was take an original trajectory given by the federal government and relocate the routing in ways that expressly took out an African-American neighborhood.
Rezoning. That's what they called it. We called it removing.
So I like that because it gets to the heart of the matter.
Yeah.
What exactly was Hamtramck doing and why?
So Hamtramck was one of the four cases that Judge Keith got as a, he was a rookie judge. He was appointed in 1967. And
he was appointed in 1967, the year of the riots.
He, 3 months after the riots.
Wow. And how long had he, sorry, I didn't mean to derail the conversation, but how long had he been a lawyer before being appointed?
He'd been a lawyer. He passed the bar in 50. So he was a lawyer for about 17 years
before
he became a judge. And he was one of the first black judges to get appointed in Detroit. And right out of the gate, as a rookie judge, he gets these four cases that all deal with different kinds of racial discrimination. As one of the, and it's all by chance.
Mm-hmm.
So the odds of a black judge getting the first of their kind racial discrimination cases were unbelievable. And yet he drew them.
Just randomly?
Yeah. Judges don't get to pick their cases. It's all assigned randomly. And so he got, the four cases were school discrimination in schools, in workplaces, in housing, and on police forces.
So let's focus in on the housing case.
So that housing case was Garrett versus Hamtramck. And essentially, Hamtramck is this town that's in the city of Detroit. It's completely surrounded by Detroit. And what had happened was a lot of white residents fled to Hamtramck after the riots as a way to leave Detroit, but not really leave Detroit. So they made their own community. And there were some black residents who were also living in Hamtramck. And essentially they were run out of the city under the guise of urban renewal. So they wanted to, they wanted to put parks in the city and update housing, but they picked only the black areas to update. And so that evolved into a class action lawsuit, and that landed on Judge Keith's desk.
And so the community was pushing African Americans out.
Yeah, it was,
What was his solution to make them stop?
Well, Judge Keith is, he became very known more for his solutions than the initial rulings. Judge Keith didn't just say, you're guilty. He said, you had to rebuild every house that you knocked down. For every black family, Hamtramck had to rebuild to bring them back. And that was, I think, a 530-house order. So, and back then, that cost, that's a lot of money. And, of course, Hamtramck appealed and went back and forth and back and forth. And to this day, it is the longest housing discrimination case in U.S. history. It's still going on.
Did they rebuild the houses? Did people get their homes?
We have one left to go.
Wow.
One left. And he stayed with, he got elevated in 1977. So he was only a district court judge for these 10 years. And then he got elevated to the appellate court. But even though he could have passed it on to a different district court judge, he stayed with that case all the way up to this day where he still oversees it.
And so the city had to rebuild housing. They had to offer it to the people who were displaced, many of whom have passed away at this point.
Right.
Did this case have ramifications beyond just this little town in Detroit?
Sure. I think this case, all his cases, something that I had to wrap my head around when researching this is that law is based on precedent. And so when you rule a certain way, that creates kind of a rule book, a guidebook for future cases to say, well, as ruled in Garrett versus Hamtramck, this happened, which means that justifies this happening far into the future. And so by having these cases be the first of their kind in the North, that paved the way for other housing discrimination cases, school discrimination cases, work discrimination cases to go forward and have a basis for which to rule against the status quo.
And so his ruling is working to prevent housing.
That's right. Even with we had the Edison case deals with work discrimination. And with that case, I won't ruin the ending of what happens there, but needless to say, companies around the world, after seeing what Judge Keith ruled on, began changing their policies.
I don't think you can give a teaser like that, because there's an awful lot of work discrimination cases. And in fact, I'd like to invite listeners out there to call in and talk about your own experiences with worker discrimination or housing discrimination or things that you think could change to make our community better in terms of those issues. If you want to share your stories, call us, but call us at 1-800-478-TALK or 550-8422. You can email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. So, Stamp versus Detroit Edison Electric.
Yeah.
How, I mean, work discrimination cases, you hear about them all the time.
That's
people
right.
are like, oh, I'm going to sue if you do X, Y, or Z.
That's right. Though, you know, back then, we have someone who very eloquently says, you didn't sue. It was happening back then, but, no, you know, you'd be out of your mind if you were a black guy trying to sue a company for discrimination because you would lose.
So what was happening at Edison at this point?
So Edison is Detroit's biggest electric company. It might be the only electric company for all I know. And Willie Stamps was this... he had a degree in electrical engineering, and yet he couldn't get a job higher than a janitor. And he says at one point they passed him up for a job because they said he was overqualified for a job that paid $1 an hour more. So wrap your head around that.
So clear discrimination. They were clearly not hiring black
and
people.
And yet at the bottom of every sheet is the line, an equal opportunity employer. And so Willie Stamps is a very fiery warrior and had no problem suing them or trying to sue them. And, of course, that lands on Judge Keith's docket 4 years after he's sworn in.
And what does Judge Keith do?
Well, the Detroit Edison case is interesting because of all the evidence that got uncovered in the course of this investigation. And by the end of it, they put the CEO of Detroit Edison on the stand, and Judge Keith himself turned to the CEO, who was a friend of his. Judge Keith was known as having white friends. You know, he crossed every line. And he turned to him and he said, now that you see this evidence, is it obvious to you what Detroit Edison did? And he said, the CEO said, no, we didn't discriminate. I think that's what really... That denial in the face of such hard evidence is what caused him to rule, you know, in favor of Willie Stamps.
And so, again, this has set precedent far into the future.
Yes. You know, you started seeing for the lawyer who tried that case for Willie Stamps went on to take on a very similar case against the Philadelphia company. At the time, Judge Keith ordered a $4 million fine, which in 1971 was unheard of for a racial discrimination lawsuit, $4 million.
Yeah. And so had these types of cases not come before judges before, or?
If they had, then they went the other way, especially in the North. You know, there were a lot of people in the North who were in denial and said the race, that's a problem in the South. We don't have that. It's very much in the North. It's just a lot more subtle.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's a lot more subtle, it's a lot harder to pick out. And when it's a lot harder to pick out, it's a lot easier to justify ruling a different way.
You know, I feel like we're still having that exact same conversation. You know, racism isn't here. We don't see that discrimination. We don't. I mean, we had a community conversation just the other day where people are like, yeah, there's so much subtle racism. So how does your film get into that conversation about racism existing where we stereotypically don't think it does?
Well, I think that kind of happened by chance. The fact that you've got these four cases that all involve everyday aspects of our lives. This isn't discrimination in a specific place that we would never find ourselves in. This is discrimination in our schools, our homes, our work, and our police forces. You couldn't find four areas of your life that you interact with more on a daily basis. And so I think on that level, a lot of people can relate to these cases.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned discrimination within the police. Another theme the film touches on is the relationship between the police and people of color.
Right.
And during one interview, Judge Keith talks about his own experiences with the police. Let's take a listen.
I have had the experience as a black man to look in the eyes of a white police officer and see the hatred and the venom and dislike that he has because of the color of my skin. But more than the hatred is the power that he possesses with the gun, the billy club, and the system behind him.
To all of our listeners, can you relate to Judge Keith's comments? What would you do to change that power dynamic? Call us at 550-8422 or 1-800-478-TALK and let us know. Judge Keith acts to change that power dynamic. I see you nodding.
Yeah.
Talk about that a little bit.
Well, at the time, in that where he says that line in that movie, you know, he's talking about a time when Detroit was over 55% black and yet 6% of the police force was black. And so when you have that kind of representation or lack of representation on a police force, that sets up a very dangerous dynamic between the people who are supposed to protect you and those who want to be protected. And that very contentious relationship is what led up to the 67 riots, where you had whites and blacks and police all clashing with each other, and that distrust.
And a decision came before him that the city of Detroit was trying to change that power dynamic.
Right, and that would be Baker v. City of Detroit, where Coleman Young, the first black mayor of Detroit, a few years prior to that case, so this would have been in 72, I believe, he instituted an affirmative action policy on Detroit's police force to try to right that wrong, and to it was the only way to get, as fast as possible, better representation. And some white officers sued, saying this is discrimination. And irony would have it, a case where white officers are suing for discrimination lands on Judge Keith's desk. It was the first reverse racism case of the North.
Ooh, talk about that. What do you mean when you say reverse racism?
It's a pretty controversial term. There are some people who just say reverse racism is still racism, which is probably true today, but in that context and in history, reverse racism was when white plaintiffs began claiming that they were being discriminated against by minorities with policies like affirmative action.
Some people argue that reverse racism doesn't exist because of the power dynamic. And so you can discriminate against white people, but to be racist against them, white people within this country still have the power. Does he take on that issue of, is there reverse racism? What is that?
I think, again, back then, because it was so new, there was less of a a focus on definitions. And he looked at every case as if it was the first and only case that he got, and he weighed both sides, and in this case, he weighed on allowing the purpose of what that affirmative action plan, which was to, he saw firsthand, Detroit's the only city to ever have two race riots where the army was called in, once in 1943 and once in 1967. That's a pretty bad track record. And so he lived through both those riots and played roles in them, and he saw that affirmative action plan as the only way to avoid ever going down that road again. And now, you've got, a city that's 83% black and the police force is 62 or 63% black. So it's much more reflective.
All right. We're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the film, The Trials of Damon J. Keith.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. It's a fact, 85% of Alaska Native and American Indian people don't use illegal drugs. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're talking about civil rights. What did you learn about civil rights as a kid? What are you learning now? How is your opinion changing? What do you think your rights are? Call us at 550-8422 or 1-800-478-TALK to let us know. Jesse, in making this film, how long did it take you to make this film?
About 2.5 years from start to finish.
How much of this was new to you? Like how much?
Almost everything.
Yeah, so you're
I'm 26.
Okay,
and,
a young white man.
A young white man doing a movie about a very old black man. I'm not from Detroit. I didn't even grow up in the U.S., and here I am trying to do a movie about a 94-year-old black judge who is a walking piece of American history.
In that process, tell me about your relationship with the judge.
I'm a more educated and far better man 2.5 years later for knowing him. When you do a movie that takes that long to do, you really get to know your subject on a new level. And in my case, that only enhanced telling his story. I always say that if Judge Keith wasn't alive to tell his own story, I don't know if I would have done it. It's still a story worth telling. But for me, what was so compelling about making it was that he was still here and so articulate. He's still a working judge. He's 94 years old today, and he still is a working judge. So for him to be able to tell his own story in his own words when so many of his peers, Thurgood Marshall and Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, died before being able to tell their story in their own words, that was a huge selling point for me to do this.
How did you change as a person?
I'd like to think that I'm, again, far more educated.
Does it help you understand race relations in our country now?
For sure. Far better than any textbook or course ever could. When you are engaged in a conversation with somebody who has not only seen, but lived, actually been on the other end of what you can only imagine when you listen to courses or watch films about it, that really... It really changes your understanding of those events. And I could empathize with them before, but I feel like I can understand them better.
What lessons do you think the judge teaches that, like, what would you put into the textbooks that aren't there now?
I think in this particular case, that he always says that one person can make a difference. And that's especially true, that's a big statement that could be applied to a lot of things, but in law, all it takes is one person with one lawsuit, and you can draw the ripple effects of that one person with that one lawsuit all the way to today, because again, law makes precedent. It's a rule book. And so if you have the courage to do, he always says, if you have the courage to do the right thing, that the effects of that will ripple throughout time.
And the film, like, you talk obviously in depth about the court cases.
Yeah.
But you also talk about him as a person.
Yeah.
And you touch a lot on his relationship with his wife, Rachel.
Yeah.
Why? Why was that an important thing for you to include?
Well, anybody who knows Judge Keith will say that it wasn't his work, it wasn't his struggles, it was his wife that played the largest part in his life and is the driving force. And unfortunately, she was no longer here with us when we were doing the film to play a role. And so we thought the best way to show her presence in his life and the way that she inspired him was through him. And to have a couple of these scenes where, you know, at first you go, why do we need to know about his wife? And by the end of the film, I think people will understand why, you know, she was integral to what he did and the person he is today.
There was one really interesting moment in the film for me when it was him and his daughter.
Yeah.
And she was talking about, as her mother, Rachel, was aging, the judge's decision to not let his wife travel to a really important thing. And just like the daughter's anger.
Yeah. That was a, there's yet to be a Q&A where somebody doesn't have a comment about that scene. And it strikes a lot of people a lot of different ways. That was one of the hardest scenes to both film and put together, because it deals with a personal decision that Judge Keith made, a man who gets paid to make decisions, making a decision that perhaps wasn't his to make, a very different kind of decision than the ones he gets paid to make. And it sort of showed that that side of him in a different light, we think. Yeah, far more personal. And a lot of people say that's a great scene, and a lot of people say that was a really disturbing scene. A lot of people have a lot of mixed reactions to that scene, and that's why it's one of my favorite scenes in that movie.
What's your interpretation of it?
I think you see two people who are obvious father and daughter, because they are both probably the two most stubborn people in that entire movie, and two different generations, two different thought processes, two different worldviews, that you can tell a lot about those two people from that one scene.
Mm-hmm. What else do you think jumped out at you about him as a person?
Just how humble he is. This is a guy who, he's the only judge to ever be sued by a sitting U.S. president. That's a different case.
And that was the wiretapping case with Nixon.
That was the wiretapping case with Nixon.
All right, well.
But he, you know, he's somebody who you would pass on the street, and he's just this little old man going out to get a donut at Dunkin' Donuts. He loves Dunkin' Donuts.
Smart choice.
Yeah. And no entourage, no sense of grandeur. A lot of the things that you associate with the stereotypical image of a judge, scary, stern. He's this warm guy that will give you a hug the first time you meet him. And he's, you know, yay high and small little black man who literally 94 years of history, and he's still going.
All right. Well, thank you very much. That was Jesse Nesser. He is the director of Walk With Me, The Trials of Damon J. Keith. It's a documentary that shows this Saturday at 4 p.m. at the Anchorage Museum. It's part of the Anchorage International Film Festival. You can see their whole schedule online, anchoragefilmfestival.org. Thanks for joining us.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and Alaska's communities and in operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by
GCI, keeping Alaskans connected to live the life they choose. GCI is an Alaska-born and raised telecommunications company and a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.